During a Playboy interview in 1976, the late President Jimmy Carter said, "I've looked on a lot of women with lust. I've committed adultery in my heart many times." What was shocking was not that he had fantasies about sex with women that were not his wife. It was that he publicly, very publicly, admitted it. And this was just a few weeks before the election, and many were sure that he had committed political suicide. Remember, it was 1976, a time when presidential candidates weren't supposed to brag about wanting to have sex, much less sex outside marriage. But in fact, I suspect my guest today is not at all surprised that ultimately it made Jimmy Carter seem more human, more relatable, and may even have had something to do with defeating Gerald Ford and becoming the next president of the United States. I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker, a gynecologist, best-selling author, and a nationally recognized menopause expert. When it comes to menopause midlife and what comes after, I'm betting you've not gotten a lot of information from your own doctor. If women are given good information, they'll make good choices. And I'm here to give you the inside information. Dr. Justin Lay Miller is a social psychologist, an award-winning educator, a prolific researcher, and is the host of the Sex and Psychology podcast. He is also the author of the popular book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life, based on his survey of sexual desire in America, including how fantasies change as women age. So welcome.
Hi, Lauren. Thanks for having me.
So, okay, do you agree that maybe that little statement on the part of Jimmy Carter had something to do with his landslide win?
It's possible. I don't know that I would say for sure or definitively that that's why he won. But I think you're so right that something like that can make somebody more relatable. Because when it comes to something like sexual fantasy and desire, most of us feel very alone in what we're fantasizing about or what turns us on. And we don't talk about sex. We don't talk about fantasy or desire. And so normalizing it in some way, I think, can absolutely make you seem more approachable and more relatable.
And much better than, I think it was President Bush when they said, oh, we'd like to have a beer with him. You know, okay, that's relatable, but it's a lot more relatable to say, my God, this guy fantasizes just like I fantasize. How cool is that? But, you know, I really do think that that has a lot to do with the success of your book. We were both on the Kinsey Advisory Board, and we were both just in San Francisco, and I was so happy to not only spend some time with you, but then the executive director, Justin Garcia, a good friend of ours, sent me a copy of your book as a holiday present. And I really honestly started reading it out of obligation because I knew I was going to interview you, but I couldn't stop. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely addictive for just exactly what you're talking about, to know that, wait a minute, I'm not the only one that thinks about this stuff. And it does make people feel less alone. What was your incentive to doing this particular study and writing the book?
Sure. So I actually never really had grand ambitions when it came to writing a book. It wasn't even on my radar. And what happened, and this actually it's sort of a funny coincidence since you mentioned Playboy at the very beginning of the show, is that I was at a conference where I happened to meet an editor of Playboy, and this was circa 10 or so years ago. And I had recently started a blog where I was writing about the science of sex and relationships, and we got to talking about it. And he said, hey, you should write for me. And so I wrote an article that was all about cuckolding fantasies. So specifically, this was about men who fantasize about watching their wives or girlfriends have sex with other men. And that article went viral, and it led to a number of literary agents reaching out to me saying, hey, you should write a whole book. And then I realized, all right, maybe I should write a book. And I thought, you know, what could I write it on? And fantasies were an area that had always fascinated me. And as a sexuality educator and somebody who had written a textbook on human sexuality, I found that fantasies were one of the most under-researched areas. Like, I had all of these questions about fantasies that had never been answered before, such as what's the connection between fantasy and reality? How many people actually want to act on their fantasies? And also, how do fantasies change across the lifespan? Almost all of the fantasy research that was out there was based on college student samples. There was nothing on midlife or older adults. And so I wanted to look at all these questions that I had about fantasies that had just never been explored. And I thought, what better way to do it than to conduct this massive survey and then just write a whole book about the findings? I knew that I was really onto something because when I started telling people about this book that I was writing, everybody was like, I want to read that book. You know, there wasn't
a single... Okay, but it's one thing to say, I want to read that book. But did they say, I want to tell you my personal fantasy so it will be in the book?
That did happen.
It's so funny because one of the things that I thought about when I was reading this is, I mean, I'm a gynecologist. People tell me all manner of things. I mean, really, you can only imagine. But no one ever tells me their fantasies. I never even thought about it before. So I'm curious, when you were doing your survey, how did you recruit? How did you get people to sign up for this? Were they eager? And you just kind of go back a little bit about how you actually recruited people to talk about their fantasies.
Sure. So for any research, you have to tell people up front what it's going to be about, right? If you're going to collect informed consent. So I was very clear that this was a study of sexual fantasies. And yeah, I was a little bit worried about conducting the work in terms of, will people want to share their fantasies with me? And it turned out that people actually seemed pretty eager to do so. And I ended up collecting this massive sample of over 4,000 adults, people who came from all 50 states in the US. And all of them were recruited online. So I recruited participants through various sources on the internet to try and get as big and diverse a sample as I could.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I thought was interesting is that in all of the studies that I've done on sexual fantasies, it's the only area of sexuality and relationships where I actually get more male identified than female identified participants. Every other sex and relationship study I've done has been disproportionately consisted of women. And I think that's really interesting that men seem to really want to talk about their fantasies. But when I started looking at the data, I found that men on average actually felt more shame about their fantasies than women. And I wondered to what extent this might be just something about guys kind of feeling all of that shame and guilt and embarrassment about their fantasies, never having a chance to talk about them with someone else. And this was actually in some way maybe therapeutic for them.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because the concept of shame runs throughout the book and throughout the whole issue of fantasy. And if you had asked me, I would have guessed that guys felt a lot less shame than women, because women are the ones that are told, you know, don't touch down there, don't look down there, sex is bad, sex is shameful. We never talk about having pleasure. Where guys, it's all about pleasure. What would you like? What are you thinking about? So I don't know. Were you surprised by that? I am.
I was surprised by it too. And I actually made the same prediction as you did, that women would feel more shame and guilt and embarrassment about their fantasies because we have a sexual double standard where women are judged more harshly than men for their sexual desires. And so, you know, on the basis of that, you would think that women would feel more shame, but that wasn't the case. It's not to say that shame doesn't exist for women. It certainly does. It's just that men on average were feeling more shame about their fantasies. And I think part of the explanation for that is that men on average have more taboo fantasies than women do. And so it might be something about sort of the nature of the things that men and women are fantasizing about that might be leading to greater feelings of shame for men as compared to women.
All right. So let me ask you this. If women feel less shame in general than men about their fantasies, are they more likely to share their fantasies with someone? I mean, I always think of fantasies as something that are very private, that no one really talks about. But do some people talk about it?
Well, regardless of whether people feel shame about their fantasies, most people still don't talk about it. You know, I found that on average, only about half of my participants had ever shared their favorite fantasy with a partner before. And most of my participants actually said that I want to incorporate this fantasy into my sex life in some way in the future, but very few of them had ever acted on it. And like I said, only about half had ever shared that fantasy before. So there's a pretty big gap between fantasy and reality where people want to share and act on their fantasies. And we see in my work and other research that people who do tend to be more sexually satisfied and they tend to be happier in their relationships. So there are lots of benefits to getting in touch with our fantasies, but we also have lots of things that are holding us back. And the single biggest thing that really holds people back is fear, right? It's not just about shame. It's about what would happen if I put this information out there? Is my partner going to judge me for being into this? What if my partner is not into it? And then how do we navigate that situation? There's just a lot of anxiety that's tied up in our fantasies.
Yeah. Well, especially if the fantasy involves something like having sex with multiple people or with a partner that's not their partner, you know, so those are the kinds of things that I would imagine would make someone feel very, very vulnerable. You know, I loved how when you started the book, just to get everyone's attention in case you didn't have it already, by revealing the top three fantasies that people have. And I'm not going to ask you all of them because I want people to read the book, but, you know, give us a little bit here. What is the number one fantasy, the most popular fantasy?
So the single most common fantasy was having a threesome or engaging in some kind of multi-partner sex. In fact, when I looked at people's favorite fantasy of all time, more than one third of my participants said that their favorite fantasy involved having a threesome. And then further, when you looked at whether people had ever had a fantasy about having a threesome, it was more than 90% of adults across gender and sexual orientation who had had this fantasy before. So even if it's not your favorite fantasy, it's still a very common thing for people to fantasize about.
If they're in a straight relationship, is the third person generally their own sex or the other person's sex? If a woman's with a man, is she thinking about another man coming in or is she thinking about another woman joining in?
So it definitely varies, and there are some gender differences. So if you look at heterosexually identified men, in their threesome fantasies, most commonly, it's them and two other women. By contrast, if you look at heterosexually identified women, they're much more split between having fantasies about bringing another woman into the mix versus being with another man. So men on average, when we're talking about heterosexual folks, are less likely to have a same-sex fantasy compared to women. Women have more of what I would call sexual flexibility fantasies, where there's more erotic exploration of same-sex or same-gender attraction. This is something that makes sense in light of the broader literature out there about sexual fluidity, finding that women on average experience more shifts and changes in their attractions and even in their sexual identities and behaviors over the course of their lives. And that seems to be playing out in their fantasies, where women, in fact, I found that about half of women in my survey had a same-sex fantasy at some point. That's not to say that it was always in the context of a threesome, but it often occurred in the context of threesomes.
You talk a little bit about the difference between someone who has a fantasy that has no interest, zero, no interest in actually acting it out, versus the person who has the kind of fantasy that they're saying, I would love to do this. And how do I tell my partner? Because I would love for them to be on board.
Yeah. So about 80% of my participants wanted to act on their favorite fantasy at some point in the future. That's not to say that everybody or most people want to act on every single fantasy that they have, but for something that is your go-to fantasy, more often than not, it seems to be a desire, meaning it's a wish or want for your sex life. But for that 20% of people who don't want to act on their favorite fantasy, what's behind that? There are a few things. So one is that sometimes the fantasy is just about something that is extremely fantastical. Maybe it takes place in outer space or on another planet or in Hogwarts or on the Star Trek Enterprise, right? You know, those were all things that came up in terms of fantasies that people have had before. So sometimes it's just an impossible thing that people don't want to act out because they literally can't do it.
Well, they can't. They don't get it. Yeah. It's just not an option.
But other times it's because they're afraid to act on that fantasy because they're concerned about what would happen if I actually did this. So one example of this would be what I call forced sex fantasies. Some people call these rape fantasies, which is a term that I don't like. I think ravishment fantasies or consensual non-consent is a better term for it. But basically the idea is that sex is being quote unquote forced upon you by someone else, even though it's something that you want in the fantasy, right? And that's what makes it different from sexual assault is that in the fantasy, you're in complete control. You pick who your partner is and you dictate the terms under which it takes place, how it starts, how it unfolds, how it ends. And for these forced sex fantasies, they were super common, but a lot of people who had them said, I would never want to act on that in real life because it would be too risky because I'd have to give up so much control to someone else and I don't know what would happen. And so there's that sort of fear of loss of control when fantasy enters reality that sometimes prevents people from wanting to act on it.
You know, one of the things that also struck me as you talk about things like a forced sex fantasy or group sex fantasy is that so many of the fantasies that women described were all about being the object of desire. They wanted to be wanted. They wanted desperately to be wanted as opposed to them desiring someone else. Did that strike you?
I thought that was really interesting. And, you know, something that I overlooked when I did the initial survey, this was something that I just had not thought about before because it hadn't really come up in the research, was what is the perspective from which people take their fantasies, right? So when you have a fantasy, what does it look like? Is it like you're watching a movie and you're a character in it? So is it a third person perspective? Or is it from a first person point of view perspective where you're seeing things through your own eyes as you normally do in daily life? And for me, I'm somebody who actually has fantasies in dreams. Like whenever I'm in my head, it's always from that third person perspective where I'm watching myself as a character in the movie. And I've started to wonder to what extent that might help to explain differences in the degree to which people see themselves as the object of desire. And so I've done some follow-up work and I've found some data that supports this point, that women on average tend to have more of those third person fantasy perspectives where they're seeing themselves as the object of desire because they're sort of watching it as a movie. You know, they're a character in it and you can see your body and your facial expressions and all of these other sorts of things. Whereas men on average tend to have more of the first person POV perspective where they're acting on their object of desire. And I think that helps to explain a little bit of the gender difference here. And it's actually something that we call erotic self-focus, which is the degree to which you turn yourself on, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. My colleague, Dr. Marta Miena, was on my podcast a while back, and she's done research on erotic self-focus and has found that it's actually a very healthy aspect of sexuality. Some people hear about this idea and they think that it's narcissism and you know, that you're self-absorbed or something like that, but it actually predicts better sexual functioning and greater sexual self-esteem and sexual self-confidence. So it's actually a positive aspect of sexuality. But women on average have more of this erotic self-focus, and those who have more of it tend to have better sexual function.
Yeah, I think that's the beauty of this research, because on one hand, we could go on and on about all of the trivia and what fun it is and who's doing this and who's doing that. But at the end of the day, the purpose of your research is to increase our knowledge of human sexuality and function to make it better. And so I was trying to look at it through that lens as I was reading the book and saying, this is so interesting. How is this going to inform us in terms of the human sexual experience, and then taking it beyond that in terms of self-esteem and individuality and how you function in the world and in society? So it's really, really interesting. Okay, so they always say that the three things you should never talk about are sex, politics, and religion. So we've already, you know, checked off sex. So now we're going to go to politics and religion, because you ask those things. You ask people what political persuasion they were, what was their religion, and then looked at their fantasy. So let's do it. At the risk of going down the political rabbit hole, you did research on Republican fantasies versus Democratic fantasies, which really got my attention. So what did you find out? I mean, how likely was it that President Carter was lusting about one woman at a time as opposed to lusting about doing all manner of things with multiple women? I don't know if I want that visual, but anyway, I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, so there's an interesting intersection between politics and sexual fantasy. And this was also something that had never really been explored before. And I kind of just looked at it for exploratory purposes, because I wondered, is there any connection there between what our political background is and what people are fantasizing about? And I found that there were some differences on average between Republicans and Democrats. And specifically, Republicans on average tended to have more non-monogamy and multi-partner type sexual fantasies, and also more taboo fantasies in general. And by contrast, Democrats tended to have more BDSM kink and power play fantasies than Republicans did. And in thinking about why this might be the case, I think ultimately it sort of comes down to what is taboo for you. And what is taboo for you is going to be different from what is taboo for someone else, right? So if we think about people who are Republicans, right? Politically, the Republican Party is very much for traditional families and monogamy. And, you know, you only have sex within the context of marriage. And with just that one person for the rest of your life, right? So violating the norm of monogamy is something that might be very tantalizing to someone who identifies as a Republican. And by contrast, if you think about people on the left politically, what we hear about a lot in Democratic circles is the idea of a level playing field and that no one should have power over someone else because that creates these exploitative power differentials and so forth, right? And so playing with power, I think, is a very taboo thing for Democratic individuals, right? Because it subverts this idea of a very level playing field. And so ultimately, I think the reason why Republicans and Democrats might be fantasizing about somewhat different things is just that what is taboo for them varies a little bit. And what is taboo is tantalizing, because the more we're told not to do something, the more it makes us want to do it.
Well, that's for sure. Absolutely. The other fact you threw out there is that Republicans were more hung up on penis size than Democrats. I don't even know where to go with that one.
I don't know where to go with that one either. That wasn't a finding that I expected. But yeah, larger penises were a bigger fixture of Republican sexual fantasies compared to Democrats. Again, I don't know exactly what the explanation is for that, but size certainly seems to matter in some political circles.
I shouldn't even say this, but has there ever been a study of someone measuring penis size according to party affiliation?
I have never seen that study. It would be fascinating to know. But I would say the penis size literature in general is just very fraught, because it's hard to get men to come in and get their penises measured. And there's always a concern about, well, who wants to participate in a study of penis size? Is it people who are larger and more confident to begin with? And so then does that artificially inflate the numbers and averages?
There's built-in bias right from the get-go. I'm going to let you do that study, okay? I'm a gynecologist anyway. I don't do penises. But I am definitely, definitely not taking that on. All right. So we've just crossed politics off the list. Let's turn to religion. What are the differences in general, depending on someone's religion, in terms of the type of fantasies they might have?
So there were a few things that came up here. Religion, like politics, you know, we saw a lot of these fantasies about doing things that are taboo, right? So for people who reported having religious affiliations and were more involved in religious services and gatherings, they tended to have more fantasies about sort of breaking free of all of those religious constraints on their sexuality. And then, you know, something else that was interesting that came up was that for men who were religiously affiliated, they actually had more same-sex fantasies. And so—
Oh, that's interesting.
That kind of made me wonder to what extent people who might harbor shame about same-sex fantasies or desires, maybe they turn to religion as a way of sort of coping with that. That could
priests.
Be one.
Is that why people become priests? I don't know.
It is a reason why some people do become priests, is because they harbor desires that they've been told that they shouldn't act on before.
Interesting. You know, you actually, I think you had 15 questions that were predictive of what kind of fantasy a person was likely to have. And I thought that was also really interesting that you ask someone these 15 questions, you don't even really need to know what their fantasies, because you already know them based on these particular characteristics, whether it's their religion or if they're gay or straight or their age group and all of that. And so there really are certain themes that you can predict based on these characteristics of people. So, all right, let me ask you this one. Speaking of, we'll move away from religion and politics for a minute and move on to what I think a lot of people are really waiting to hear about, and that's age. So let's start with the 20-year-old versus the 50-year-old. Who's going to have the more wild, crazy, kinky fantasy?
Well, so the stereotype would be that younger adults would have the most adventuresome fantasies, right? There's kind of this stereotype out there of the horny college student, and we assume that they're having all kinds of threesomes and wild sexual encounters and so forth. But it turns out that it's actually people at midlife who have the most adventuresome sexual fantasies. So I plotted out people's fantasies by different decades of life. And what you see is that you have changes as people are progressing through the lifespan, which I think reflects the fact that there's some kind of developmental time course of our fantasies. It could also be that there are just generational differences and, you know, what is in vogue when it comes to sex. Certain historical periods in time kind of influence or shape what your sexuality is. So, you know, I think it's probably a bit of both, that to some extent our fantasies are changing, but to another extent, they're also just a product of our generation and kind of what we grew up with around sex.
Okay, but how much of it is maybe, I'm just throwing this out there, very few 20-year-olds are in a monogamous relationship. And if they are, it certainly has not been a long-term monogamous relationship, probably about, what, 10 minutes or something like that. But if you look at your typical person who's in their 40s, 50s, 60s, very often they have been in a mutually monogamous relationship for decades. So how much is their fantasy world a product of they're just friggin' bored? You know, the monotony of monogamy that says, okay, I cannot have sex with this same person and do the same thing one more time, so I'm going to get all in my head about what else I'm doing. And is that, do you think there's any truth to that?
I think there's absolutely truth to it. I mean, you know, as I was saying, like there's this stereotype about younger adults. Another part of that is that people kind of assume that it's young adults who are the most interested in non-monogamy and polyamory. And, you know, we hear a lot about this in the popular media. But again, if we turn to my data, and it's not just in this study, but in several other studies that I've done, I found that it's people in their 40s and 50s who are the most interested in non-monogamy, polyamory, open relationships, having threesomes, engaging in swinging. And I think a big part of that is that, you know, if you think about somebody who's in their 20s or, you know, somebody who's roughly college age, a lot of these individuals, like you said, have not had a lot of experience with relationships. Like many of them just want a relationship, let alone many relationships at the same time. By contrast, for people who are in midlife, most of them have been involved in long-term monogamous relationships because monogamy is the dominant relationship style. And we know that people tend to grow bored of sexual ruts and routines, and that sexual desire and passion is something that is really difficult to sustain and keep alive in a long-term monogamous relationship.
Listen, if you have pancakes for breakfast every day for 30 years, you don't really want pancakes for breakfast anymore, even if you really like those pancakes at one time. You know, one of the things that's interesting is, of course, both of us are senior research fellows at the Kinsey Institute, and they're the ones that really did all this groundbreaking research on consensual non-monogamy, open non-monogamy, whatever you want to call it. And I heard a presentation by a Kinsey researcher last year, and one of the questions I asked is this something that you see across the ages? Because I, of course, thought that this was something that was going to be primarily in 20-year-olds, and the data is very clear that 1 out of 5 people have practiced consensual non-monogamy at some point in their life. We're not talking about cheating. We're talking about consensual non-monogamy. And this includes people in their 30s, 40s, 50s. So if you look at a 50-year-old in terms of the fantasies they have, who's more likely to have wild fantasies? The 50-year-old who's had the same partner for 30 years or the 50-year-old who's been divorced for 5 years and has had many interesting partners in the interim? Do you have, and what I'm getting at, is it their age? Or is it their relationship circumstance that seems to have the biggest impact on these wild fantasies that you're telling me people have midlife?
Yeah. And what my data would suggest is that it has a lot to do, and perhaps mostly to do, with your current relationship circumstances, right? When people find themselves in a relationship where they're having certain needs that aren't being met, they're more likely to fantasize about opening up in some way. And it's not always just about sex, right? When we talk about consensual non-monogamy, there's sort of the assumption that it's just, I want to have somebody else to have sex with. But consensual non-monogamy is also about meeting other needs. It's about having somebody else that you can talk to, somebody else that you can engage in non-sexual activities with, right? For many people who are in monogamous relationships, they often have to cordon off a certain aspect of the self that their partner isn't interested in, right? Maybe your partner doesn't share the same exact hobbies that you do. And so this leads a lot of people to have this experience of feeling like they've lost their sense of self in the relationship. And that actually prompts a lot of people at midlife to engage in infidelity or to open up their relationships, because it's a way of sort of getting that autonomy, independence, and sense of self back.
Yeah. Well, and that makes sense, because when people have friendships, platonic friendships, non-sexual friendships, people have more than one friend that meets different needs. But yet when it comes to sexuality, there is this very American idea that that's not acceptable, that one person has to meet all of your needs. The other thing that caught my attention was the part about what guys prefer as far as pubic hair styles. And the reason that caught my attention is because I actually did research on that. I polled 1,000 men a few years ago, It was in my biggest bedroom deal breakers survey, which I never published, but I should because it was really quite amazing. And in my survey, most of the men said that they preferred in a female partner that their pubic hair was either neatly trimmed, or the second most common answer was they didn't care. They were just happy to be invited to the party. But your survey had very different results.
Yeah, in my research, what I found is that when you're looking at heterosexual men's fantasies about women, most of these women don't have any body hair and their pubic hair is either completely gone or there's just a very small amount that's present. It was only 3% of heterosexual men in my research who expressed a desire for a full bush, meaning no pubic hair removal at all.
Yeah, well, full bush was very low on my list as well. But the question is the difference between reality and fantasy, because we didn't ask the same question. I asked, when you're having sex, what is your preferred pubic hairstyle? You asked, when you're fantasizing about having sex, what is your preferred human pubic hairstyle? So is that why we got different answers, or just different people, different time?
It's probably a little bit of both, right? It's very often the case that researchers will ask about, even if they're asking about the same thing, if they're asking about it with different groups of participants, you're not going to find statistics that are going to match up exactly. But also just the way you phrase the question, even a slight wording change can evoke very different results. So in terms of what you do in real life versus what you do in your fantasies, that can be two very different things, right? And, you know, it could also be that just when people are fantasizing, some people aren't focused as much on certain details, like adding pubic hair or other things like that. You know,
or faces, what their face looks like.
You know, there are lots of people who fantasize about a vague, faceless person, right? And yeah. In fact, women have that fantasy much more often than men do, where there are just certain details of their partner that are just absent. And in part, that sometimes goes back to you being the object of desire, and it doesn't matter so much who your partner is.
Right. What difference does it make? This isn't an emotional thing. This is a he has to have me thing. It's like Erica Jong, who, you know, I think was really the one that made that come front and center in Fear of Flying. But you think that also there's an element of a fantasy about having sex with a prepubertal girl, because that's one of the things, of course, that a lot of women object to in terms of removal of pubic hair is I don't want to look like I'm a 9-year-old.
Yeah, you know, and I think part of this is also influenced by pornography consumption. You know, I find in my work that there is a correlation between how much porn people are consuming and certain characteristics of the partners that they have in their fantasies, right? So for example, the more porn that heterosexual men watch, the larger the breasts on the female partners that they have in their fantasies, right? And you also see that for heterosexual women, the more porn that they watch, the bigger the penises on their male partners and their fantasies, right? And so the characteristics that we see on people in porn can shape to some degree what appears in terms of our fantasies. And we know that in pornography, that there's been a trend in recent years where there hasn't been a whole lot of pubic hair for women. And that might be a product of something that's being reflected in our fantasies, because our fantasies don't exist in a vacuum. They are shaped and influenced by the social context, the cultural context in which we live. And if the cultural context says that the standard of beauty or attractiveness is to not have pubic hair, that can start to become reflected in what it is that people are fantasizing about.
Yeah. And I actually have done some work on why people have pubic hair and the history of pubic hair. And a lot of it doesn't hold true anymore. You know, as an example, in the time of the caveman, it was cold. And you can't have sex if you're cold, and you can't maintain an erection if it's freezing out there. So pubic hair was a way just to keep the genitals warm, which is generally not the case today. So things do change. Things do evolve. All right, let's move on to celebrities, because people sometimes, not always, but sometimes do fantasize about celebrities. And of course, I went right to who are the most common celebrities that women fantasize about, because of course I have, you know, my go-to. And and number one on your list was Channing Tatum. I mean, are you kidding? I mean, he would be like number 1,000 on my list, and that's at best. So what is it? What is it about Channing Tatum that made him the number one object of desire for heterosexual women?
Well, I think I should first step back and mention that when it comes to who we fantasize about, more often than not, we fantasize about people we know, and we're fantasizing about our partners or just other people that we know and find to be physically attractive. It's actually a lot less common for people to fantasize about celebrities. Most people will have the occasional celebrity fantasy, but we're not super hyper fixated on them in our fantasies usually. But when it comes to someone like Channing Tatum, why were so many women fantasizing about him specifically? I think it has a lot to do with sort of his specific facial features, his body, his general masculinity, right? And that was sort of a general theme across kind of the male celebrities who kind of appeared on that list, was that there are all these very masculine looking and acting men in some way, right? So that was just kind of a broader characteristic of a lot of the male celebrities who appeared in women's fantasies. And, you know, by contrast, when you look at the women who are appearing in men's fantasies, they're often women who kind of conform to the social or cultural ideal of what women's bodies should look like in society. Again, culture, society set these standards for attractiveness. And I think that very much creeps into our fantasies.
And then there's the Sarah Palin fantasy. Oh my God. Go, yeah. Just go. Tell me, talk about that for a minute.
So I also asked people, you know, do you ever have fantasies about politicians and political figures? And I found that politicians were the least fantasized about group that I asked about.
Go figure. Yeah.
It's much more often that people were fantasizing about celebrities or porn stars or even comic book characters like politicians, like were very low on this list. But when you looked at who were the specific politicians people were fantasizing about, when you looked at female politicians, Sarah Palin just blew everyone else out of the water. There were very few other female politicians who were mentioned. Part of that might reflect the fact that women represent a much smaller share of politicians in general. Some people might not have as much awareness of who current female politicians are. And so, you know, Sarah Palin might just be a name that more people were familiar with, and that's maybe why she dominated.
Think about that. You know, ask people to name five prominent female politicians, and people would have a hard time. And Hillary Clinton, and I love her, but I don't think she's probably the object of desire for most guys. I'm just saying.
She was on the list, but you know, compared to Sarah Palin, not very many people had Hillary Clinton fantasies.
All right, I promised we have to do this. I want to talk about, as women age, what happens? So first question, in your survey, I know that you had a broad, broad range. What was that range in terms of age?
It went from 18 to 88.
All right. And roughly speaking, and I'm most interested in perimenopause and postmenopause women because that's what I do. So if we look at that 45 and older group, was that a significant portion of your survey?
Yep.
Okay. All right. So just tell me what your thoughts are about aging and fantasies, and at what point do they start to change, and how do they change, and what are your insights about that?
So when I first started looking at how age was related to sexual fantasies, I tested for simple correlations, which are looking for a linear association, right? So as age increases, this fantasy also increases or it decreases, right? And when I tested to see, actually, is this a linear phenomenon or not? What I found was that it's actually curvilinear, where these fantasies kind of have this ebb and flow over the lifespan that we're talking about. In other words, you could kind of think of it in some cases as a bimodal distribution, where maybe the fantasy is low early on, it peaks at some point, and then decreases again later, right? So I find that the relationship between age and fantasies is actually pretty complicated. So to give you a couple of examples, one of the things that I found was that kink and BDSM fantasies were very common for women who were in their 20s. So for young women, kink and BDSM, very popular fantasy. But when you start looking at it over the course of time, you see that it starts to drop off and it becomes much less common at midlife and even less common as it goes beyond that. So that's one example of a fantasy where there was sort of this linear association with age where it became less common as women got older.
My audience is probably not as sex savvy as your audience. So could you just quickly say what BDSM stands for?
So BDSM is an acronym that stands for bondage, discipline, dominance, submission, sadism, and masochism. So
thank you.
it runs the spectrum, but it's basically anything involving power exchange or sadomasochistic activities where you're mixing pleasure and pain.
Thank you. Okay. Now that we got that cleared up.
Okay. Now, if you want to look at a fantasy that's more bimodal, that would be in the area of non-monogamy and multi-partner sex. Mm-hmm. What we see is that interest in these fantasies among women is actually lowest among younger women, so women in their 20s and 30s, but it increases and reaches its peak in its 40s and 50s, and then it starts to decline after that, mm-hmm. right? So that's an example of a bimodal distribution where multi-partner sex, non-monogamy are most appealing to women at midlife and women who are kind of at that menopause transition stage.
Well, hormonally, that makes sense. Because during perimenopause, when women are having this roller coaster activity in their ovaries, and there have been many studies which show that there is an increase in sexual desire in general during perimenopause, which for most women tends to be in the mid to late 40s, early 50s, when there's just in general more interest in sex because they're not just getting variation in estrogen, they're actually getting surges in estrogen and even a little bit of testosterone. So it would be interesting and expensive and unrealistic to actually measure hormone levels in women, then correlate them with their fantasies. Wouldn't that be a fun study?
It'd be a very fun study. And, you know, I think there is something to what you just said there about hormones and biology and how these things change over the course of our lives and how that influences and shapes our fantasies, right? Because I'm very much a biopsychosocial theorist when it comes to fantasies. There are biological, physiological factors that affect our likelihood of even having fantasies and also what we fantasize about. But then there's also the sociocultural factors and our own individual psychological factors. And I think too, you know, at different stages of life, different things might become more appealing, right? So when we're talking about multi-partner or non-monogamy fantasies, that might be particularly appealing to midlife women who maybe have been in long-term monogamous relationships, who maybe haven't had their sexual needs met, or they just want to try something new and different. You know, that could be part of the story as well. But also, if you think about something like kink and BDSM, I think part of the reason that becomes less appealing to women with age is because one of the big reasons people are drawn to kink in the first place is because they're trying to change their headspace. They want to get out of their head and be in the moment. And for a lot of young women, they really struggle with things like sexual anxiety. And so kink and BDSM are appealing to people who kind of struggle with anxiety, distraction, worry, all that other sort of stuff. And I think when women start to reach midlife, a lot of them actually become more sexually self-confident. They understand better how their body works, what it is that brings them pleasure. And so they might not need as much of that sort of distraction or escape. And maybe they just want something else, something different from sex.
But again, do you think this is just in someone's fantasy life? Or do you think that midlife women want to act out on this BDSM sort of fantasies?
Well, so at midlife,
or any fantasies, you know, when we talk about this acceleration and what you're saying women want, is this just in the fantasy world or is it in the real world?
So I think at midlife, there is this increase in terms of people wanting to act out their fantasies, right? Because there's sort of a new urgency to kind of do something with these fantasies or desires that maybe we've harbored for a long time, because eventually we come to a point where we start to realize that, hey, if I don't do this now, I might never be able to do it, right? So that's part of it. But there's also the fact that as we get older, we tend to care a little bit less about what other people think. And so that opens the door to us exploring and trying things that we otherwise felt too afraid to do earlier on in life. And so I think that's also part of why at midlife we become a bit more sexually adventuresome. It's because we've stopped caring as much and we're going to do what feels good for us or what it is that we really want to do at this point in life.
So if we are making the premise that maybe all of this is tied up with hormonal fluctuation, what's going on with men at midlife? Because their hormones have not started to jump up and down and all over the place. They're pretty steady.
So it's interesting, you know, when I plot out fantasies and age and separated by gender, the male and female patterns actually mirror each other pretty closely.
So we're seeing so much for our hormone theory, you know?
Well, so, you know, hormones can still be part of it, but I think it has a lot to do with just sort of where we are in life and those changing relationship circumstances that kind of creates these different patterns in our sexual fantasies. But there are some gender differences. Like, for example, something that I thought was really interesting was that if you look at the oldest adults in my sample, those who are age 65 plus, something interesting you saw there is that, you know, for younger ages, women compared to men had many more fantasies about passion and romance. But when you start looking at older men and women, you see that reverse, where men are starting to fantasize more about passion and romance than women are. And I thought that was kind of intriguing, right? That, you know, maybe there's something happening later in life that is sort of shifting and changing the way that men are thinking about sex. Maybe it has to do with changes in how the penis functions, and maybe you need to expand your definition of sex. But that was just an interesting finding for older adults that I found.
Yeah, well, my overreaching theme is always no penis, no problem, because most penises are not really working the same way by the time a guy gets to be 60 plus. You end the book with a really wonderful section on how fantasies can enhance relationship, because at the end of the day, that's where we're going with this, right? And there was so much good stuff there. But I just want to focus on one little aspect of this, because I think it's so important, is in general, is it good for a relationship to discuss a fantasy with your partner, even if that fantasy is about having sex with someone else? Is that going to enhance the relationship in any way, or is that something that people should keep to themselves?
So more often than not, I find that talking about your fantasies, no matter what they are, is linked to better relationship outcomes. Now, to be clear, that's not to say that talking about your fantasies always leads to positive outcomes, right? Sometimes it does lead to negative outcomes. And I think, you know, look, if you look at the specific numbers from my survey, you're finding that the vast majority, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of people are saying that it was a positive experience for me to share my fantasies with my partner. But you've got, you know, somewhere around 1/5 or so of people who are saying it was a negative experience. And I think in terms of what predicts having a positive versus negative experience, it's going to depend a lot on, do you have trust and intimacy in your relationship to begin with? Do you have good sexual communication?
So a good relationship, it will only make it better. And a bad relationship, it can really backfire.
It can really backfire. And, you know, that's one of the problems, is that sometimes fantasies are only introduced when a relationship is already failing, right? Where they introduce the fantasy as a way to try and save the relationship. For example, it happens all the time that people will try to open up their relationship when their relationship is already on really rocky grounds. And then that just does not work, right? Because the communication, the trust, there are other issues there. That's the worst possible time to open your relationship, right? So part of it, yeah, is sort of just about the general state of the relationship, but it's also about the nature of the fantasy and your partner's personality and the way that they think about and approach sex, right? So if you're sharing a fantasy about having a threesome with your partner, and let's say your partner's very high in attachment anxiety and somebody who does not deal well with stress, right? That might be seen as a threat to them and something that actually undermines closeness in your relationship. So yeah, it's not always the case that sharing your fantasy is going to lead to positive outcomes. More often than not, it does, but you have to think about it on an individual case, like, and evaluate what are the potential risks and rewards, and how do I think my partner is likely to respond to this based on what I know about them.
So interesting. All right. What didn't I ask you? What should I have asked you? What else do you want to say before we finish this up?
Oh, I mean, I could talk about fantasies for days. In fact, I have actually taught a 16-hour workshop on fantasies before. So we could talk about this endlessly. But
well, that means I just have to have you back, right? I mean, I have to admit, you know, this is not my usual topic. We hit sex, religion, politics, penis size. That's not usually on my agenda. So this was really fun for me.
It was a lot of fun for me too.
All right, I'm going to put everything in the program notes so that people can find your book, they can find you, they can find your podcast. And thank you so much for this really amazing, interesting conversation.
Thank you.
I'm Dr. Lauren Stryker. Thank you for joining me. For more information, along with access to articles, webinars, videos, my newsletter, and much more, go to substack.com/@Dr. Stryker. That's substack.com/@Dr. Stryker.